Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Unitarian Universalism is a religion with no creed, but we're united under a set of principles that revolve around mutual respect for one another and for the earth on which we live. Today we're going to develop our monthly theme of perseverance with a message in the persistence of time and fossils. I hope you enjoy it. If you are new or are visiting, we especially welcome you and hope you will sign our visitor log in the narthex. And if you have placed a joy or a concern in the basket out in the narthex, or actually Elka has that now, those will be read after the offertory. I have a couple of announcements. There is a Black History Month breakfast on February 24th at 9 a.m. to noon at the Bethel AME Church, 401 Yuma Street. $7 for all-you-can-eat pancakes. The Path to Membership class will be on the stage in the Alsop Room after the service. And finally, there is Tuesday at 7:30, there's an orchestra concert at McCain that features Matthew Meals, our pianist, and he will be playing his winning concerto piece. So if you can go to that, that would be great. That's Tuesday at 7:30 at McCain. All right, at this time we'll proceed with the lighting of the chalice. These words are by Wendell Berry, The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night, at the least sound of fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. We will sing our opening hymn, number 42, Morning So Fair to See.
Thank you.
time for the anthem.
We sang this first on a Sunday about 10 years ago, and then 7 days later we sang it at the ordination of Jill Jarvis, now at Lawrence. And we opened with in the singing portion with an anthem an Alleluia for Our Time, which we've sung a number of times. And then this one came second, but I didn't conduct it. A woman conducted it who was a dancer, and she moved around and jumped and stuff, and it sounded really good. My choir has asked me to take a more sedate approach to bringing them along here.
Better bring all of the young and the young at heart to the front for our story for all ages. This is my first time doing this. I might seem a little bit nervous, so bear with me. And I'm going to put together for you a little story about dinosaur bones. So what do you think of when you think of dinosaurs anyway? Yeah.
Ancient times.
Ancient times, oldness, yeah. What else?
Big giant reptiles.
Big giant reptiles, oh boy. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, anybody else? Go ahead.
Scary stuff.
Scary stuff, okay. One more.
Big ones.
Big ones, okay. All right, we'll get yours too. What did you have? Birds. All right, birds. That's a really nice observation because that's going to fit right in with my message. All right, so, and this is a true story. I'm going to tell a little story here about, you know, some dinosaur discovery, basically. About 200 years ago, lots of people in North America and Europe were discovering all kinds of useful and wonderful things that were in the ground. They mined those things from the ground with shovels and stuff. They found coal, things like coal and iron for making machinery, coal for burning to make energy and to warm houses, and metals that you could use to make really nice things, lots of metals. And they also found this stuff called marl. Now, marl is nothing really that seems all that special, but it's kind of sticky, and you can make clay, you can make pots out of it, and so on. But you can also fertilize your yard with it. It has a lot of calcium in it. There's a lot of uses for marl. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So somebody suggested to her that she put her used clay in the plants to fertilize. Yeah, that's awesome. That's right. So all of these things were valuable, and they came from the ground. Imagine if you owned a piece of land where some of these valuable things were found. You'd feel lucky, and you might want to make some money too, right? Well, people hired diggers to come and dig from the ground and sell these things to the market. And the diggers, especially the ones working in these marl pits where the clay was, found some really interesting things. And they were bits of seashells and bones and little fragments and things that bore resemblance to lizards, smaller lizards that now run around in our fields. And when they brought those curiosities to their children, people were amazed at all the strange and wonderful things. Well, people started to study these. This was over 200 years ago, just a few years before I was born. And so from the seashells found in the marl, it was obvious that at one time these areas had been at the bottom of the ocean, right? So how could that be, right? They concluded that the skulls and bones must be left over from the ancient flood, the story from the Bible of the ancient flood. So the story told of how all the creatures, except for those of Noah's Ark, had drowned, right? Have you guys heard that story? Yeah, it's an interesting story, but yeah. Yeah, lots of cultures. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true, yeah. And so, whether it's Noah or some other guy, right? Surely, these strange bones could only have come from the ancient flood, right? But there were some others who said, well, wait a minute. There's something that doesn't really quite fit. So they collected the specimens, and they wondered, and they asked questions. You guys like to ask questions, don't you? So one of the owners of a marl pit in New Jersey, so this is over, most of this was going on in England or in Europe, but there was a guy in New Jersey who had one of these marl pits in his backyard, and he hired some workers to dig up the marl because he wanted to make money too. And they found this huge, huge, complete, almost complete fossil in his backyard. He thought it was a curiosity, and so he said, leave it be. Don't disturb it. Leave it in the ground. Well, one day, meanwhile, back over in England, a scientist had written about ideas that he used to explain that
that these scattered fossil bones in the marl pits must represent some unrepresented form of life that was large and it roamed the earth and we'd never seen anything like it. And people thought, heresy. How could that be? This isn't what we've been told all of our lives. So, were dinosaurs around when the volcanoes erupted? Yeah, but you know, they're erupting still, so yeah. But there was probably a lot more of that activity. Yeah. Did you want to say?
Some of the seashells and stuff, one to Kansas, part of it had a sea. And once we went to a farm on a field trip, and a kid found all kinds of shells.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's lots of shells around here in the hills. You can find those in the fossil beds. Yes.
I have a rock that has a lot of shells in it.
Oh, wow. A rock with lots of shells. Yeah, I have a few of those in my yard. I loved looking at those shells. They're kind of cool, aren't they? Well, so maybe I can abbreviate my story to less than 6,000 years. Huh? So anyway, what happened was that people thought that basically the earth was created in a really short time for some reason or another, like a week. It's just what they'd always been told, and that it was done by a very powerful force, like a god with amazing powers, and he did it really quickly. About 6,000 years ago, right? So how could it be that these giant lizards had been totally missed by all humans before this? This must be just a huge misunderstanding, right? Somehow we're just misinterpreting these fossils. And for many years, a great debate raged about, you know, what could this possibly mean? So meanwhile, back in New Jersey, Mr. Hopkins, he was the guy in New Jersey, he had a friend over for dinner, and he said, hey, look, I've got this great big cool fossil in my backyard. And his friend was a fossil collector, and he wanted to see it, so he showed it to him. And he took him back there, and the guy knew immediately what this meant. It meant that, because he was really familiar with all the talk of these great, the ideas about these great animals that must have once roamed the earth, and he put it together in his head. He said, this is it. This is the proof. So he published it, and lo and behold, this was a giant dinosaur named Hadrosaurus fulcii. And it was displayed in the Museum of Natural Science in Philadelphia. I think it's called the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia now. Have any of you guys ever been there? You should go. You should go. It's kind of like the one at KU.
I'm in kindergarten.
Oh, you're in kindergarten? Yeah, right. So, well, you should try it. I mean, you can get there, I'm sure. So, the existence of all dinosaurs had been proven, and these folks had persisted in their idea that, or persevered is the word I really should use, in their idea that, hey, there was something really different about things that they thought was the way things were. And by persisting or persevering in their ideas, they were able to overturn these long-held assumptions about life on Earth. And so, birds, back to birds. Do any of you guys know that birds are actually just modern-day dinosaurs roaming the Earth? Yeah, I think some of you knew that. So pterodactyls were actually a flying form of a dinosaur that pre-existed the birds. But anyway, so many fascinating things. And this weekend, there is a pterodactyls without sharp teeth. Okay, I'll buy that. Anyway, so whenever you have a great idea about something, don't just lay it down. Persevere and let everybody know what you think. Okay? That's my message for today from this story, and I hope you liked it. Go and love our hearts.
Sorry, nobody wanted it.
Oh, sorry.
have our offertory, and we'll have special music by, I'm sorry, we'll have our offertory now, and the special music will be after the offertory.
Once more this week, we cried and grieved as our hearts went out to people who have experienced a school shooting. Once more, we've had anger and fear and all kinds of emotions come up around that. And that's a time that needs to be named, a time that does touch all of us. And though we know that thoughts and prayers are inadequate, we have those thoughts and prayers for those in Florida who have been so affected. We also want to keep this morning Mark Mosier in our thoughts. His mother passed away earlier this month. And the other things that we have this morning are joyful. We're proud of the UUFM youth who represented themselves so well at the 4-H showcase yesterday. Jake Larson, Maeve, Rose, and Ronan, Tanona, and Clara Mayfield. And Kathleen and Maeve Tanona are on their way to Haiti on a medical mission. Maeve's trip is partly supported by the fellowship, and we're hoping they have a safe and successful trip. And in other news, Ronan made it to the county spelling bee, but got out on the word vinyl. And finally, we have a joyful opportunity next Saturday to join Bethel AME Church to celebrate Black History Month from 9 to noon. And so we carry in our hearts the joys and concerns that have been expressed, and our sympathies and celebrations are with those even who have not expressed those things out loud.
Stand.
We can contemplate those and whatever else, as we have the joy of having a special guest artist this morning, Aaron Ford, who used to be a member of this congregation.
Let my people let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go.
Thank you, Aaron. That was wonderful. This reading comes from More Scenes from a Rural Life by Verlin Klinkenborg, and it develops our fossil theme for today some more. This comes from 2005. It's a story from 2005. Last month, a team of paleontologists announced that it had found several fossilized dinosaur embryos that were 190 million years old, some 90 million years older than any dinosaur embryos that had been found so far. Those kinds of numbers, 190 million, even 90 million years, are always daunting. Ever since I was a boy in Iowa, I've been learning to face the eons and eons embedded in the universe around us. I know the numbers as they stand at present, and I know what they mean. In a roughly comparative way, the universe is perhaps 14 billion years old. The Earth is some 4.6 billion years old. The oldest hominid fossils, between 6 and 7 million years old. The oldest distinctly human fossils are about 160,000 years old. The truth of these numbers is like watching the night sky in the high desert. It fills me with a sense of nonspecific immensity. I don't think I'm alone in this. One of the most powerful limits to the human imagination is our inability to grasp intuitively the depths of terrestrial and cosmological time. That's hardly surprising since our own lives are so short in comparison. It's hard enough to come to terms with the brief scale of human history, but the difficulty of comprehending time on evolutionary scale is one of the major impediments to understanding evolution itself. It's been approximately 3.5 billion years since life first originated, we think. That's not an unimaginable number in itself if you're thinking of simple discrete units like dollars or grains of sand. But 3.5 billion years of biological history is different. That's not an abstract lump of time. It's not a mathematical set or a kind of scientific shorthand. All those years have really passed, moment by moment, one by one. They encompass an actual, already lived reality. The sum of all the lives of all the organisms that have come and gone in that time. That expanse of time defines the realm of biological possibility in which life, in its extraordinary diversity, has historically evolved. Time has allowed the making of us. Now we'll sing hymn number 301. Please join if you will, or please stand if you feel able, and we'll do that.
When we look at the broad sweep of time, the billions of years we just witnessed, what does perseverance mean for us measly human beings who almost certainly will live less than a full century? What do we experience when we place ourselves next to a time scale that goes beyond our imagining? When I have looked at a 1,000-year-old redwood tree or a 1,000,000,000-year-old mountain and imagined the very nearly endless march of days they have endured, no other word can name my emotion than awe. Our own lives shrink in significance, disappearing in the span of time into specks that, if visible at all, stay paltry, trivial. And at the same time, in the awe that stirs, something tells me that I'm connected with it all. Many of our Christian friends this week had the experience of ashes being imposed on their foreheads while someone intoned, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Or as Nadia Boltz-Weber of the House of All Sinners and Saints put it, "Happy Ash Wednesday, you are going to die." The Jewish rabbis have another approach to that story. They tell the story of the man who holds in one pocket the words, "You are but dust," and in the other pocket has the words, "For you, all of the earth and heavens were created." Either way, the threat of an end does loom. What does perseverance mean in the shadow of the ominous threat of nothingness, where whether our personal demise or the planet scale end of the Earth 5 billion years from now? And can we look to nature and science not only for comfort, as Wendell Berry in the reading that Mark offered at the chalice lighting talks about the comfort of knowing nature and being where the wood drake lies, but can we also look to nature and science for insights into human traits like perseverance? Because there is something in the perseverance of the stars and the fossils and the redwood and the mountain, something timeless that feels eternal, that could teach us something about perseverance. Nature remains one of our best coaches and exemplars. At least it does for those who consider themselves religious naturalists. Now, who's familiar with the term religious naturalism? Do you know that term? A couple of people. Well, let me explain it. Religious naturalism is an orientation that invites us to look to nature for meaning. Like humanism, religious naturalism looks to science more than to ancient texts for its grounding. Religious naturalism, though, does not preoccupy itself with human affairs. It breathes in that sense of awe in looking at that 1,000-year-old redwood or the 1,000,000,000-year-old mountain or the stars scattered across the heavens, and it recognizes the connection between human being, and all these other forms of being. It knows that we are literally the dust of the stars, that we are a part of nature rather than apart from it, and that all that we learn from the study of nature invites us toward a deeper understanding of ourselves and how we ought to be in the world. Religious naturalism, then, helps make sense of our world, as all religions do, and is a natural path for many who identify as Unitarian Universalist. Religious naturalism is a spiritual path, too. Philosopher Roger Gottlieb offers us this definition of spirituality. In its broadest terms, spirituality is an understanding of how life should be lived and an attempt to live it that way. To be a spiritual person, then, is simply to see the value of spiritual virtues and to make them increasingly important in your life. So, the religious naturalist will use their observations of the natural world as the grounding for the spiritual virtues. They will use naturalistic intelligence, exploring the environment, observing carefully, recognizing patterns, and making subtle connections. They will use their keen senses and hands-on engagement to learn and draw conclusions. Nature becomes our teacher. Reading the book of the earth, naturalist Chet Ramo calls it. Oh, I'm hearing those winds now. When Marissa suggested that fossils might be an image of perseverance, and her fossil frame is here as our visual focus this month. So when she suggested fossils as an image of perseverance, it prompted me to ask, as a religious naturalist might, what lessons the fossils give us of perseverance. They have lasted a really, 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 really long time. So what do they tell us about lasting a long time? Now, fossils, of course, are not conscious creatures as we are. Even when those organisms lived and moved on Earth, they did not have the kind of consciousness that we do. They didn't endure because they decided to. They did not make decisions about how to persevere. We human beings, on the other hand, get to make choices about how to play out the traits we want to see in ourselves and the results we want to see in the world, and that may be for good or ill, or both. The plants and animals that became fossils simply followed their natural instincts to be what they were and to become, eventually, a preserved record of what they once were. On the other hand, we think, we choose, we learn. Perhaps, though, we can consider the natural intelligence of beings that simply follow their natural instincts. As religious naturalists, what might we learn from fossils? At first glance, fossils remind us that the way of stuff, of matter, is to go on, to survive, to endure. And that's demonstrated in the law of conservation of matter, that matter is neither created nor destroyed in a chemical reaction. Yes, it gets more complicated as matter and energy trade places in physics or whatever, but the general law for usual circumstances is that matter, though changing forms and rearranging its constituent parts, matter survives and continues. It perseveres. Sometimes in a fossil, the whole organism has been preserved, frozen or dried or encased in amber. Its form has remained intact through the process, even because of the process. More often, though, fossils, though, have been altered through some method. The matter does not remain as it was. Often what persists is the image of the organism imprinted into rock, a trace of carbon, like a charcoal sketch left behind. Sometimes the fossil's substance has changed as minerals in groundwater have replaced the minerals of the organism. There may or may not be organic matter left in a fossil. Forms change. And yet, the evidence of the organism remains its identity clear. So one of the lessons of perseverance from the fossils is that the form and character may change yet keep the identity intact. And that reminds me of the need to be open to what's going on and what perseverance means in the particular context. It may not mean cleaving closely to how it's always been done or holding on to an idea of what ought to be in denial of changing circumstances and climate. Perseverance need not transform into stubbornness. It leaves room for adjustments and accommodations. Rather, we want the core to survive despite the processes that go on around it. Fossils maintain their identity. Their form and structure endure, though flattened with the pressure of the rock and twisted and folded with the earth's movements. The details that remain can be astounding. Naturalist Chet Ramo describes ichthyosaur fossils in the National History Museum in London. He writes, one ichthyosaur specimen in the gallery contains six unborn young inside its body. And another has three unborn young with the almost perfect impression of a fourth being born tail first, just as the mother died. A Lyme Regis ichthyosaur has bits of another ichthyosaur between its teeth. Part of the creature's last meal. To move along the gallery from specimen to specimen is like being taken back 200 million years to vanished seas teeming with monsters eating and being eaten, mating and bearing young. Ramo goes on to write about how the fossil collectors had extended time far beyond the bounds of here and now. Geologic time is on a different scale than human time. What looks like it may not pay off in human time may indeed come to fruition over a longer time than we could imagine. What's more, even human time has not always been perceived in the same way. Time, wrote Klinkenborg in the reading Mark offered earlier, has allowed the making of us. Time is such a crucial element to perseverance that it deserves a little consideration. And we could even call time key to perseverance. Continuing on a course for a few seconds or a few minutes is not perseverance. Rather, perseverance requires a long-term commitment over time, so that the passage of time, in a way, fails to matter or is suspended or goes unnoticed. Certainly, the fossils did not dwell on the passage of time. We do, though. In this age of information, we have become impatient with anything that takes more than a second. We have trouble waiting for the buffering to end. We expect an immediate response to our texts. We are no longer conditioned for perseverance, believing goals should be achieved quickly. Our grandparents may have been a little better at perseverance since they were more used to the speed of walking than of flying. They were used to waiting longer for food to cook and letters to arrive. Their time horizon may not have been on the geological scale, but it may have been more human. Go back thousands of years, though. Ancient peoples, as well as some indigenous people today, saw time as cyclical, following the change of the seasons, the cycle of the moon, the ebbs and flows of the tide, the repetition of sunrise and sunset. In contrast, we've been taught in our culture to view time as linear, something that comes from the known past and progresses toward an unknown future. That allows us to envision an arc of history bending toward justice. A linear conception of time permits trust in progress, an idealization of a future that is to come, and it also allows us to fear a future apocalypse. What if we were to take closer notice of the cyclical elements of time in our efforts at perseverance? Or what if we saw time on a much larger scale? Perseverance may look differently with an altered concept of time. We cannot persevere with something with the same intensity that we use for a one-time effort. We may need to see time in a different way in order to persevere. We may need a long view or a cyclical view. In the cyclical view, perhaps to persevere, we work for a season at something and then come back to it when the season is right again. That could be a kind of perseverance. Maybe that would help to keep us from seeing ourselves as quitters. And in the long view, you don't know what of your legacy will survive. Certainly those preserved fossils did not know the record of their lives would endure. You don't know. So often people try to create a legacy, but a legacy is not crafted. A legacy is what others will see when they look back someday. You can't know what that will be. I wonder, when Moses and Aaron and Miriam set out across the desert with the Hebrew people, after Moses had gained that freedom from the Egyptian Pharaoh, I wonder if they had any idea where they were headed. They longed for freedom but did not know where they were going. They wandered 40 years in the wilderness, at least that's what the story says. 40 years is a biblical phrase that means a really, really long time. To wander that long tells me they didn't know where they were going. And yet they persevered, as did the former slaves they inspired on this continent thousands of years later. Marge Piercy's poem, The Perpetual Migration. How do we know where we are going? How do we know where we are headed? Till in fact or hope or hunch arrive. You can only criticize the comfortable say, you don't know what you want. Ah, but we do. We have swung in the green verandas of the jungle trees. We have squatted on cold gray granite hillsides where every leaf drips. We have crossed badlands where the sun is sharp as flint. We have paddled into the tall, dark sea in canoes. We always knew. Peace, plenty, the gentle wallow of intimacy, a bit of Saturday night and not too much of Monday morning, a chance to choose, a chance to grow, the power to say no and yes, pretties and dignity, an occasional jolt of truth. The human brain, wrinkled slug, knows like a computer, like a violinist, like a bloodhound, like a frog. We remember backward a little and sometimes forward, but mostly we think in ebbing circles a rock makes on the water. The salmon hurtling upstream seeks the taste of the waters of its birth. But the seabird on its 4,000-mile trek follows charts mapped on its genes. The brightness, the angle, the sighting of the stars shines in the brain, luring till inner constellations match outer. The stark black rocks, the island beaches of wave-worn pebbles where it will winter, look right to it. Months after it sets forth, it says, home at last, and settles. Even the pigeon beating its short, whistling wing knows the magnetic tug of arrival. In my spine, A tidal clock tilts and drips, and the moon pulls blood from my womb. Driven as a migrating falcon, I can be blown off course. Yet if I turn back, it feels wrong. Navigating by chart and chance and passion, I will know the shape of the mountains of freedom. I will know. The poet tells us that there is some internal force that helps to guide her, and perhaps by extension us, and maybe even those Hebrews and other former slaves, draws us to what to pursue: peace, plenty, love, choices, growth, beauty, dignity, truth. We are like other animals in recognizing what we pursue. Like the salmon and the seabird and the pigeon, we will know when we reach those goals, those precious goals. We pursue them with commitment, with perseverance. Even if blown away, blown off course, we can find our way back. We will know. This week, we have again seen a horrible massacre wrought in a school, a place we expect children to be safe. Discouraged by legislators' refusal to listen, we nevertheless persevere in yelling that this is abominable, that such massacres must stop. This month, we honor Black History Month, a practice that has existed in one form or another in this country since 1926. Yet our official stories of history continue to resist full inclusion as the white supremacy permeating our culture persists in ways that we persistently try to interrupt. This year, we have struggled to resist the derision and subjugation of women, of immigrants, of Muslims, of Native peoples, of African Americans, of queer people. We need the quality of perseverance to stick to our message of compassion, equality, love, and justice. One thing that we gain from nature is an opportunity to recharge ourselves in order to keep going. Another thing we may gain is lessons. Lessons from the perseverance of the natural world. Lessons from the way the animals follow their internal courses. May we hold on to the image of what we seek as the fossil has held its imprint. May the illusion of time slip away from us as we remain intent on our goals. May we recognize the shape of the mountains of freedom. May we find peace, plenty, the gentle wallow of intimacy, a bit of Saturday night and not too much Monday morning, a chance to choose, a chance to grow, the power to say no and yes, pretties and dignity, an occasional jolt of truth. May we persevere. I invite you to join in our closing hymn, number 350, The Ceaseless Flow of Endless Time.
This tune was harmonized and spiritual by Harry P. Burley, the son of slaves born in Canada just after the Civil War. Our pianist had to go home. She was ill. And so, yeah, you just give me a couple of B flats there, and we'll see what we can do with it.
The
ceaseless flow of endless time.
And now, in closing, the words of Laura Lynn Bellamy. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you've found comfort, go and share it with others. If you've dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you've known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace.